Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Turn up the radio and sing along. It's time for another great song. This is the Great Song Podcast.
Season's greetings and welcome once again to the Great Song Podcast. I'm Rob Alley.
I am JP Mosier.
And we're here breaking down the greatest songs in modern music history. We're going to tell you why they're great, why we think they're awesome, and why you should too. JP, how you doing today, man?
Fantastic, Rob. Just went to Burger King, had some Twix pie out the freezer. Right out the freezer.
Out the freezer. Was that your request?
That was not requested. That was suggested by Natasha. She said, get some Twix pie right out the freezer. So I did. I should have waited a little bit instead of jumping straight in out the freezer. Should have let it thaw out a little bit.
Because it just tasted like cold material?
Cold chocolate.
Cold molecules.
Cold ice cube frozenness. Yeah, I heard on the way over here, too, they're making a Rambo 5.
Wow.
Yeah, he's Twix pie and Rambo 5.
Still out there Ramboing.
71 years old.
Hey, I mean, if he's still mad, I guess he's still got...
I guess so. Would you rather be rescued by a 71-year-old or just stay in captivity? Like, I couldn't get out on my own, so I called Grandpa Sly.
I mean, I guess it depends on who the 71-year-old is. If it's Sylvester Stallone,
it's cool. Yeah, that's
then
true.
Maybe so, but otherwise...
If it's James Taylor. I don't even know how old James Taylor is.
That's true. He's got to be, I mean...
Right around there, hovering.
Yeah, totally. Let's find out.
While he's looking that up, we are actually going to be covering a James Taylor song today.
Wow, what a segue.
Hence the James Taylor reference. We will be covering... You want to tell him the song, Rob, while you're looking that up?
Well, if you're going to cover James Taylor, you almost have to start with Fire and Rain from the album Sweet Baby James.
Absolutely. If you're not going to cover Blossom or Lo and Behold, then you pick Fire and Rain off of Sweet Baby James.
That's right. James Vernon Taylor was born March 12th, 1948. So while I do that math, let's take a listen. Here's Fire and Rain by the one and only James Taylor.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again.
I always thought. I mean, why would you not?
For all the years.
I always thought I'd see you again. And I did. You're here.
Here we are.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, we're back again.
Oh my God, I'm back again. Michael Sylvester Gardenzio Stallone. Michael Sylvester Gardenzio Stallone is 71.
71.
And James Vernon Taylor is 70.
James Taylor just seems older than Stallone.
It really does. Yes.
If you're going to say one of these guys is my grandfather,
yeah,
it's James Taylor.
Definitely.
Yeah.
He seemed like... Stallone is finally to the point where he kind of seems old.
Sure.
But James Taylor has seemed old
for a long time.
A long time.
Yeah, he came out the womb old. I mean, I guess on this cover, he doesn't look so old.
But he doesn't look super young.
Yeah.
He was like 21.
This is in 1969.
Yeah.
December of 69.
So he's literally 21.
He's 21, but he looks, I mean, he could be.
He could be 35.
He could, yeah.
He could easily be 35 on that album cover.
James, we love you, buddy.
You're great. We kind of just got an old face.
Just look old.
I don't really know. Yeah, okay, so James Vernon Taylor, Born March 12th, 1948, a five-time Grammy Award winner, which I should have looked up all the Grammys that he has won, and I did not. Ordinarily would have done that. Inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. He is one of the best-selling music artists of all time, having sold more than 100 million records.
That's a lot.
Worldwide. Insane. Today we're talking about his breakthrough hit from the 1970 album, Sweet Baby James. We're talking about Fire and Rain. This is his first, this song was a number three single. His first number one came the following year with his recording of You've Got a Friend, which was a cover. I didn't know that. Did you know that?
That's Carole King's.
Carole King's. Mm-hmm. I guess I just didn't know. Didn't realize You've Got a Friend was a cover. I thought it was his.
Do you know the story about this? Is on this?
Go.
The You've Got Bonus a Friend time. Was a kind of a refrain or response to the line, or it was the response to the line. I've seen lonely times when I couldn't find a friend.
Really?
And she's like, "You got a friend."
Oh, that's so sweet.
There you go, buddies.
Carole.
We'll get to her on Meet the Band.
Oh,
I've got some good Carole King stuff.
Carole, you're a good gal. Okay, this is number 227 on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs list.
That's as close to the middle of the pack as you can get.
Just right about there, right smack in the middle, that middle median there. If it was a highway, this would be right in the grass.
There you go.
Between the...
Tweener.
Yeah, this would be right there, sweet spot, right in the middle, you know? It's not one of the the 400 to 500 where you think, oh, that song should be way higher.
Sure.
And it's not in that top 50 where you go, that song doesn't belong there.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
It's right in the middle.
Right smack in the middle. this was his, Sweet Baby James was his second album produced by Peter Asher, who has since produced tons of people. I think this may have been, this was among his first production because he originally started as sort of an A&R rep for Apple Records, which was the company owned and run by the Beatles when they started to do their own record label. And then he produced James Taylor and then went on to produce tons of albums with James Taylor and others, Linda Ronstadt, Bonnie Raitt, 10,000 Maniacs, among...
I thought you were going to say 10th Avenue North.
10th Avenue North.
You're like, no.
Yeah, Peter Asher, man. The entire album, I think this is funny... The entire album had a budget of $20,000 for recording, and it was recorded at an actual cost of $7,600. They were left with a surplus of almost $14,000 at the end of recording. That would never happen anymore. Not only those kind of budget numbers, which would, you know, even in
that's modern one track.
Yeah, in modern money, that's still like a $50,000, you know, cost. That would just, no matter what the budget is now, you're going to be asking for more. You're never coming in under budget on anything ever in history. Never. This was the last time in history that something came in under budget. His first album, he had some success right away, but then he kind of drifted off into some problem areas, and he had a full blown heroin addiction, and so a lot of this album is kind of his response to that and dealing with, you know, fame and then, his addiction and those kind of things. And
he was actually homeless when he recorded this album.
Yeah, I saw that he was basically
on the
was
couch
like,
of Danny Korchmurder, one of the guitar players.
Yeah. And he was just like, all right, who can take me home tonight?
Yeah.
You know, whatever. It was an important album. He had a good reason to try and get the album done. He was promised $20,000 that would be given to him when the album was delivered. Now, I don't know if that's the same $20,000 as
the budget.
They're like, okay, you've got 20 grand. Use whatever you need to get the album done, but whatever you have left over is yours.
Maybe he's like, I got 14K in the bank.
Yes, maybe so. Or maybe those are separate amounts. You know, I didn't see if there was a...
I do know the last song on the album, The Suite for 20G, is a reference to that. And that's what you can talk more about that.
Well, I just saw in the research that he just sort of shamelessly, like, just pieced together. You know, last season we did the Abbey Road episode, which was sort of a mishmash of a bunch of partially finished songs. So the James Taylor song that finishes out this album is called The Suite for 20G, and it's the same kind of idea. He had pieces of songs, three songs, and put them together into a quote-unquote suite, and that became the last song for the album and got him his 20 grand. So smart guy. And it's sort of the same same technique that Blues Traveler used to write Hook. They're like, all right, we got to get this, you know, whatever. And so that became, they're like, it just seems so shameless. Like, you think, oh, James Taylor probably on the artistic integrity scale is, you know, pretty high up there. But maybe that one reeks a little bit of, you know. But then again, hey, if I was homeless, psh, I mean.
I just belched Twix pie. And it tastes like the original frozen bite. Sorry, everyone.
Gross.
My apologies. No visuals out there. Where are we going from there?
I don't know.
Sorry for the detour.
Jeez. Okay. Fire and rain, man. Fire and rain, boy. All right. So here's what you all want to know. What's the song about?
What's it about?
It turns out it's pretty sad.
Sad tune.
I just kind of always figured, I mean, you kind of get it. You know, this is about somebody who's not around anymore and probably dead, I guess. But it's a little, it's kind of even a little bit sadder than that.
When you dig in.
Yeah. So the song is actually about kind of three different phases, not phases of his life, because it was all sort of mashed together in a year or two's time, but three different
events or problems.
Events, yes, in James Taylor's life. And the first and probably most important and the impetus for the song is the suicide of his childhood friend, Suzanne Schnur. And that is the Suzanne referenced in the first verse.
The Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you.
Yes.
Is what he referenced there.
Yes. And he said they, I read in an interview that he said that the quote unquote they is not a reference to a specific they. It's more of like the fates, you know, it's the like the
cosmos.
Yeah, the universe, you know what I mean? Kind of did you wrong. And he was always afraid that like her parents would hear the song and think that it was about them.
Oh man.
Like that he was, you know, throwing shade at them. But he, you know, he said that's not the case, but that's just the way the line, you know, kind of needed to come out. So, yeah, she, was, you know, was troubled and ended her life. And so he wrote this song partly in response to that. Part of it is also about, his, movement to, London to audition for Apple Records. He found himself kind of alone in London, and the second line about look down on me, Jesus, you got to help me make a stand. It's not really about Jesus either, but it's kind of a, he said it's kind of a prayer of like having to like pull himself together to do this audition, and to, he had gotten dropped by his label after his first album because it, I guess it didn't perform as well as they wanted it to, but he said the second verse is about my arrival in England with a monkey on my back, and there Jesus is an expression of my desperation in trying to get through the time when my body was aching and the time was at hand when I had to just do it. And then he said the third verse refers to his recuperation. He went into a treatment facility, that kind of thing, after his drug heroin addiction, and so that's about his time in recovery in a place called Austin Riggs, which lasted about 5 months. So all those things kind of taken together for this one very sad but very iconic song. And it's weird because the song doesn't really come off sad to me.
No, it's just a folk song. It just seems like a campfire song.
Yeah, right. It kind of makes you feel good. It gives you kind of a warm, you know, I mean, it's not kumbaya, but it's just,
it's comfortable.
Yeah. I don't know why. It's pretty obviously a downer of a song. Like, you know, oh, I always thought I'd see you again. You know, like,
maybe it's because it's heard so much and played so much. It just kind of becomes like familiarity.
Yeah. Maybe it is just comfortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, maybe when I heard the song when I was three, I thought, oh man, that's really sad. But you know, I mean, that's true though. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just something that you grew up hearing, you know, over and over and over, and still being played today. So maybe so, I don't know. This was kind of the song that took James Taylor from a kind of a, well, it's kind of shot him into the stratosphere as far as this. And he, you know, the, something I didn't realize until researching this was the sort of singer-songwriter movement was just in its baby stages. Up at this point, if you were a songwriter, you weren't necessarily, you probably were not the artist who was singing those songs.
You would pitch your songs.
Right. I would write a song and you would sing it. And I don't know how that, I guess maybe it's sort of the advent of video. You know, people start making TV appearances and that made, I don't know. I don't know why it was that the system was in place that like.
Because you look at the people that ended up being good singer-songwriters, and it's not like they're super great showmanship or like it's not the presentation. So, I mean, it's them and acoustic guitar. It's James Taylor, it's Jim Croce, it's Harry Chapin. It's that kind of, you know, it's not like they're stage presence geniuses. It's them on a bar stool with an acoustic guitar.
Yeah, so I wonder why it took so long for that to become a thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I guess, I don't know, maybe there was just a feeling that, you know, you got to really put on a show and grab people, but I don't know why. I feel like, what did Sinatra do to snap. A degree that James Taylor doesn't do? Yeah,
walk around and snap and smile.
I mean, yeah, you know. So I don't know, I thought that was interesting. But his first label deal. Uh-oh, do I have this wrong? This says his first label deal was with Apple Records. Was this his second one? Yes, I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
okay.
No,
his first album was with Apple, and they dropped him.
Yeah. Do you know any other artists on Apple other than Beatles referenced ones?
I don't.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, that's pretty cool that he's on, you know, there. But then I was like, who all is on Apple?
Yeah.
So basically everything other than Wings and Yoko and that kind of stuff and the Big Four.
Yeah.
I looked up the only two that I knew on there, Billy Preston and Badfinger.
Really?
That was the only ones that I even knew.
Interesting.
Like, who they were.
And Badfinger's only hit, I guess, really was a Lennon McCartney, If You Want It, Here It Is, Come and Get It. And Billy Preston played with the Beatles.
Played with them.
In
so
the studio.
Still
and that
kind of a tie-in.
Yeah. But, interesting. Yeah. So James Taylor was going to be the guy, the American breakout star for them. And for whatever reason, the first album, they dropped him afterward. And he signed with Warner Brothers, who released Sweet Baby James. The title track was issued as the first single, but failed to chart. So, man, he was probably like, God, what do I got to do? You know what I mean? But he was on the road promoting the album, and when Fire and Rain was released as the second single, it took off. They said the first one, his first album had, first of all, I think it was interesting, just to put these in correlation, he recorded his first album in London in the same studio where the Beatles were recording the White Album.
Oh, cool.
Those two albums happened at the same time, and he was on Apple Records, and he's recording in the same studio.
Wow.
Like, so his, and that produced Carolina in My Mind, Something in the Way She Moves, but it sold poorly due to a combination of his heroin addiction, because he had to seek treatment and couldn't promote the album, and Apple's kind of implosion as a label. You know, that was going on due to the Beatles infighting and all that stuff at the same time. And Yoko, it was Yoko's fault. Yoko did all of it. So that led to him being dropped by Apple. And then he, you know, gets picked up with Warner Brothers. So let's talk a little bit about the production. It was produced, the album was produced by Peter Asher. And he was looking for a kind of a stripped down sound to showcase James Taylor's songs. He didn't want to cover up the greatness of the songs with production that sort of outshined, you know, he thought, man, these songs are great. Too much production will get in the way. And so that sound he kind of found on this track. He called in the musicians, who we'll talk about in just a minute, probably right after this. And he had them just come in to rehearse the song in his living room. The drummer was a rock drummer, but Peter Asher asked him to play with brushes during the rehearsal so they wouldn't bother the neighbors. And when he played with brushes instead of sticks, it brought out kind of a new vibe to the song and gave them the sound that he was looking for. That was kind of a more stripped down, more intimate feeling, you know, sound.
House concert.
Yeah, like a house show. And so That band became part of James Taylor's touring band, and they went on to play classic 70s albums by Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, Carole King, who was also involved in that band. So I thought that's kind of cool. This is kind of the birth of that chill singer-songwriter vibe, like that coffee house. Mm-hmm. You know, you bring a full band into a coffee house, you're normally not getting big Marshall stack amps and whatever. It's an acoustic guitar, and it's, you know, some light drums and, you know, whatever, maybe a stand-up bass.
Upright bass, yeah.
Yeah. And this double is bass. Kind of the genesis of that in modern pop music, which I think is very cool, and I definitely did not know before that. So with that lead-in, why don't we take a second and let's meet the band.
Let's meet the band.
Hey, let's meet the band. It's time to meet the band. Hey, mama, let's meet the band. Let's all meet the band.
Hey! All right, we're going to meet the band of the band On Fire and Rain. I'll touch a little bit on the band from the album Sweet Baby James. I'm just going to read it off the back of a...
Sweet Baby. Sweet sounds like an baby James. Exclamation, like Great Caesar's ghost.
That's right. Sweet Baby James.
Sweet Baby James. You scared the crap out of me.
Sweet Lincoln's mullet. Or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Sweet. On guitar and vocals, James Vernon Taylor. We'll throw out some James Vernon Taylor facts later, probably. But so we'll skip on down to Carole King. We'll go to her next. Carole King plays piano. She has written or co-written 118 hits that cracked the Billboard Top 100.
How many?
118. So she's been a part of that, and that's just from the years 55 to 99. So wow. In that span, she wrote 118.
That's insane.
Her album Tapestry is money.
Classic.
Number 36 album of all time, according to Rolling Stone. Scott, You've Got a Friend, which we talked about earlier. I Feel the Earth Move. So Far Away, It's Too Late. Way Over Yonder, You Make Me Feel, in quotes, like a natural woman.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so money album, money artist. She actually played with him on the 2010 Troubadour reunion tour, and I saw him in Nashville, and it was so good. Mm. It was the two of them together.
Oh, I bet that was great.
And they were just smiling, hanging out.
Yeah, I feel like artists like this, like her, like James Taylor, and a few others, get better with age.
Yep.
Like... They just are so relaxed, and
it was such a chill show. Like, yeah. And it was, yeah, they played each other's songs.
I was gonna say, they always
told stories that had nothing to do with the song.
Yeah,
we
do.
Yeah, it's like it was perfect. I'll be Carole King and you be James Taylor. So yeah, it was really good.
That's awesome. They always play with you. You always know you're gonna hear a rock solid, great sounding band when you go hear somebody like that. Just tasteful. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't have to try anymore.
Yeah.
They're not, at that point, they're not trying to impress you or win an audience. They're just like, here's what I've been doing for 50 years.
And I felt like they liked playing their hits. Mm. Like, they're like, it was all hits all night.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, oh, we're going to do 7 songs that you've never heard and tell awesome stories because we like them.
Yeah.
It's like they liked the stuff that we like. Mm. And that made it so much better because everyone was singing with them.
Yeah.
And an acoustic show when everyone's singing is just better because you can hear it around the venue. And so that was really neat. So Carole King on piano. On drums.
Shout out, by the way, to our friend Leah LaRocco,
yeah,
who lives in Nashville, works for the Grammys, and who is the world's biggest Carole King fan.
She was at that show. I saw her going into the show together.
There you go.
Not hanging out together, but we did see each other. So howdy,
Leah. So Leah, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
That's
we
right.
love you.
And I don't think I've gone to one James Taylor show since then, but every time he comes, the tickets are so expensive.
I bet.
So save up your money if you're going to go see Jimmy. On drums.
Sweet baby Jimmy.
On drums, Russ Kunkel, or Drums and Brushes, which we talked about earlier. He played with everybody in that era, from Bob Dylan to Harry Chapin, Linda Ronstadt, Neil Young, Jackson Browne, Neil Diamond, Carly Simon. But most notably, you'll like this, he's Eric Stumpy Joe Childs in Spinal Tap.
No
Russ
freaking
Kunkel is
way.
Stumpy Joe.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I'm so happy right now.
So that was for Rob and those of you Spinal Tap fans out
That's
there.
Amazing.
He was in a band at that time called The Section, which is the best name ever for a rhythm section backing band.
True.
I love it. It's him and Leland Sklar, Danny Korchmer, who also plays on this, and Craig Dorge. And they played with a lot of people, which I think is so cool if you're a rhythm section and then you're just the rhythm section for all these guys.
Yeah, I love that. Like, Just hit us up like the, what was the famous studio session that, like the Hit Machine? Is that what it's called? The Hit Machine?
Yeah, I've seen
Anyway,
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So cool, cool stuff on that. They also have their own album, The Section. It's called Fork It Over. And I listened to just a little bit of it because it's got David Crosby and James Taylor on it. It's pretty good. And oh, neat fact too. That band was the backing band on the 2010 reunion tour that I saw them with, which is another little...
I call the section.
Little bonus there,
just call them up.
On bass, Bobby West, or double bass, if you would. He played with Buffalo Springfield, Diana Ross, and he rewrote... The version that you hear of the Etta James At Last on the radio now, he did the music for that.
Oh, okay.
So, like, they put her vocals with... the music that he put together,
gotcha.
Which I think is kind of neat. And the double bass is the lowest pitched bow-stringed instrument. So there you go.
That makes sense. It makes sense. Okay, a little bit of this isn't music theory. This is sort of instrumental theory. But if you didn't know this, the longer a string is, the lower the pitch that it sounds at. So and the same is true for horn instruments. The shorter that they are, think like a flute versus a tuba, mm-hmm. right? A tuba is really, really long. If you extended it, it would be very long. So it's coiled up so
trombone's
that it's carryable.
Gonna be longer, but not.
Right. Trombone. So you think like flute, really high, clarinet, high, trumpet, high.
Mandolin, like, high.
Yeah, mandolin, short,
tiny
high.
Strings.
But then the longer something gets, same as the reason why a lot of times tall people have lower voices than short people is because their inner pipes, there's more space, and as an airway elongates or a string elongates, it gets lower in pitch.
I am 4'2", everyone, for those of y'all that hear me out there. On the album and not on this track, Danny Korchmer's his name. On the back of the album, I was just reading this, it actually says Danny Cooch. So I'm guessing that's a nickname.
Maybe a nickname,
maybe
yeah.
Maybe a nickname. And I got a great fact on Danny Korchmer that I'm going to tie in back to a previous one. He is Ronnie Pudding, the bass player on Spinal Tap.
That's amazing.
Give me some money.
Wow.
Two Spinal Tap references for Rob off of this album and for you fellow Spinal Tappians.
Dude, my brain just exploded from happiness.
Ronnie Pudding and Eric Stumpy Joe Childs played on the...
Not to be confused with one of their other drummers,
Stumpy Pete.
Joe Stumpy Peeps. No.
Yeah.
No, so yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to... Anyway. Also on bass on the album, but not on this track, John London. It's kind of neat on the back of the album. It just lists everybody and the instruments they play. So it made it really neat when you were looking over and looking this up. His best friend is Michael Nesmith of the Monkees.
Yeah.
And so he traveled with the Monkees and played bass so Peter Tork could play keys on some stuff.
Cool.
So he was not a member of the Monkees, but he just traveled with the band because he was best friends with Michael Nesmith. And if they're like, okay, we want to, you know, let him play keys, come on up and play.
That's cool.
And I like when people do that. I actually got to...
Yeah.
I did a show or two with you guys in 10 days after, even though I wasn't part of the band.
Yeah.
I had to come up and play keys
just
on some
come
stuff.
Come on, man.
Yeah, come on. And that was the neatest thing. So I really like old John London for that regard. On steel guitar, O.J. Rhodes. His nickname is Red Rhodes, and that's actually what it says on the back here. But he shifted from playing steel guitar to mainly being a shop guy and working, like, he had a shop and did electronics and shop work on guitars. And I thought that was kind of neat. So I looked, I'd say he's a pretty good teacher because look at the two people that worked in his shop staff, David Schechter and Michael Tobias.
Wow.
So it's like if you're going to have two shop guys that
make
Schechter and Tobias,
wow,
I'd say you're a pretty good teacher.
Yeah.
So I think he made the right choice by going shop versus performance.
That's so funny. You know, sometimes people find their... It's funny. You just find your calling on, oh, you think I'm going to be a performer, but then in the process, you end up just doing something totally different, but that is, A, way more fulfilling for you long-term, and then B, produces something awesome in the world, outlives you, like your legacy. His legacy is, these guys that worked for me became high-end, you know, especially Tobias,
yeah.
You know, like...
And Schechter's not...
Schechter's not nothing. I'm just saying, like, you think Tobias, you think that's a high-end mm-hmm. instrument. Like, that's very cool.
Yeah, and this is kind of on the same subject, but that just kind of triggered something in me. I think one of our favorite sound guys, David Gosnell, I mean, he was a performer before. And he's only ran sound for me once, and it was amazing. And it made an impact with when we did that thing in Jackson. So
yeah, shout out to David Gosnell,
you're awesome.
You know everything.
You're so cool.
You're one of my favorite people.
Good job, buddy. So that's what I've got on Meet the Band, because I obviously missed Chris Darrow on the back of the vinyl. So sorry, Chris. He played fiddle on here, but I didn't look up anything on him because I must have just zoned out.
Is that on the Oh Susanna track?
Yeah, probably.
Probably so?
Which is the only track on this album that James Taylor did not write. That was written by Stephen Foster.
Yeah, that's an old, what do you call that era? You know, just kind of an Americana from previous generation. Like it's almost ragtime era. It's not exactly, but I didn't realize, because I guess I've never listened to this album on vinyl. I've only listened to it on CD or, you know, digital.
Greatest hits is where you hear most of the stuff off.
Yeah. That's true. But I didn't realize that Fire and Rain was the first song of side B.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Susanna feels like such an intro to this song. You know what I mean? They feel so intertwined that it's weird to me to think about hearing Oh Susanna, then having to flip over the record and then hear Fire and Rain. But it probably, I wish that I could go through and sort of have that experience first and see what it feels like. It might sort of double down on the feel of Oh Susanna, you know what I mean? Make you go, I don't know.
Won't you cry for me?
Yeah.
Fire and Rain.
Right? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I just wonder what that... If you're listening out there, seriously, in all seriousness, hit us up at Great Song Pod on Twitter. Hit me up at Worship Nerd. Hit JP up at Penny Trader 10. And let us know, like, if your first experience with this song, if you're from that generation or you're just now listening to it and it's on vinyl, if your early memories of this song were it being side one on vinyl, how did that feel to you? Its separation from Oh Susanna that way, did it make a difference in the way that you experienced this song? Or the way that they tied together, or did it make, like, for me, I'm dumb enough that I might not have caught the correlation if I had to flip the record over. If they weren't immediately back to back, I might not have known, like, I get it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I probably would have disconnected my brain and go, all right, here we go, side B. And it starts off with this
completely different.
Yeah. Who knows?
And Oh Susanna following Country Road is like, because that's the other hit.
Yeah.
It's just like that little pocket of good. If you listen on CD, it's just, you know, most people would skip ahead to maybe track four and start with Steamroller.
Right.
Then you'd go Steamroller, Country Road, Oh Susanna, and Fire and Rain and be like, okay, I'll listen to the album.
Right.
You know, but if you're doing it on vinyl, you have to tuck your paws.
Yeah.
So good call on that, Rob. I like that. So that's Meet the Band.
Hey, we met that band. And what a band they were.
And oh, what a band they were.
All right. Random notes on this. In 2015, James Taylor appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and told Stephen that he had updated the song. He said, "The thing is, when I wrote that song in 1970, I just hadn't seen that much back then. Mostly Fire and Rain. So that's why I keep saying it over and over again since then." Taylor then explained that over the ensuing decades, he's updated the song to include all the things he's encountered, such as skinny jeans, 50 Shades of Grey, snakes on a plane, and especially calzones. Taylor and Colbert then performed a highly ironic version of Fire and Rain and Calzones, packed with post-1970 pop cultural references.
Do you want to play the chorus?
Yeah, let's do
just
it.
Just play the chorus of Fire and Rain and Calzones.
I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen the rise and fall of the Beanie Baby's trend. I see man buns, MySpace, and the Baja Men. But I never thought I'd see a new Star Wars again.
That's great. That's fantastic. We don't want to hear you, Stephen Colbert. Nobody wants to. That's fantastic. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Now, if you had asked him to do that when he was
72,
yeah, when he's 23,
yeah,
do you think he would have done it?
Well, there's not as much to joke about. I see what you're saying, though. Do like a pun of your own song,
yeah.
Weird Al your own song up,
yeah,
probably not, because I mean, I don't know.
He's always seemed to have had a good sense of humor.
Sure.
Like
now, if you'd have said, "I'll give you $14,000 to do it," he
yes.
would. I think he would have sold out.
Absolutely,
I think so.
Yeah, it seems like he definitely
desperate for the cash.
Would have needed the money at the time. Yes. Yeah, it's always cool to see somebody who can kind of poke fun at themselves and not take themselves too seriously. At this point, you know, I mean, he's 68 here, you know, in this video, so he's like, what have I got to lose?
Sure.
You know what I mean? He's not trying to impress anybody anymore.
He's like, I've looked like I'm 68 for the past 40 years anyway, yeah, so...
People have been waiting for me to die for like so long.
I'm going to beat you, Stallone. Me and you, Rocky 23.
Me and you till the end. He'll do the soundtrack. What if James Taylor exclusively did the soundtrack to Sylvester Stallone's last movie and then they both died?
Oh my God.
You know what I'm saying?
This just took a turn.
It's like Rocky 15, Rocky's great grandchildren in the ring.
And then at the end it says dedicated to Suzanne Schnur.
Oh,
dude.
Dang. And Adrian.
Oh, yeah. Talia Shire.
Jeez.
And Adrian. Yeah man.
But good. Like dedicated to one real person and one fictional person.
Man. That was pretty deep. I like that section.
Start crying.
Should we go to covers since we just did kind of a cover?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do covers. I think the most true to the original, which I would call the best cover because it sounds the same, is John Denver's. Have you heard it?
No.
It's the same. If you play it, it's like, "Oh, it's John, it's exactly the same."
Now, is that a general rule for you on covers? Like
that John Denver is the same as everybody?
I feel like
John Denver's the
I feel like John Denver is just the same. Like there's no better word I think to describe John Denver than
the same.
He is the middle. It's the status quo. Yes, he's before any flavoring is added.
It's John
Denver.
There's
John Denver.
Yes.
John Denver is the same.
He's the same Denver. That's it.
He's great, but he's just so extraordinarily sane.
Yeah. So that
one. My question was, is it your rule on covers that your favorite one is the closest to the original?
No.
Most faithful?
No, not at all. And we're going to do some cover shootouts this year that I can't wait to dig in on that. But absolutely. I liked this one, and it happened to be the most true to the original.
I got you. Okay.
Maybe just because I really love the original.
Yeah.
So we'll just say that. Another one that's a little faster. Did you listen to any covers or anything?
I did not. No.
One that's a little faster, it's got a little more pop and bounce, is the Babyface version. Mm. It's good.
I have heard that one. I didn't go out and listen to it during research.
I liked it too. And then the Willie Nelson version is pretty good. And it's kind of the same too. It's a little more twang, but same concept.
Willie Nelson is an amazing musician.
He is. Great guitar player.
Fantastic guitar player.
Underrated guitar player.
Yeah, absolutely. And his guitar is
smells.
I guarantee you.
I bet
his guitar / weed cabinet is... but it's got the wear that he has on his guitar that he's been playing forever.
It's amazing.
And it's all worn through. It's got literal holes in it from him playing. Like, that's the mark of an instrument that is loved and has character.
Sure.
And you know that somebody has just bonded with that instrument.
Absolutely.
Like, oh
like
my
a
gosh.
Pet.
Yes,
that's
like a pet.
That's like your pet.
Shout out to Sean Perkinson, guitar instructor at the place we went to college, I just remember his guitar, the back of it was just all worn.
The G&L?
No paint. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just no paint. And I was like, oh, yeah, that guy loves that guitar.
Pick up the EMP project for those of y'all that are at McKay's.
Absolutely.
It's pretty good.
Or some Kings of the Killer Fish.
Kings of the Killer Fish,
if you're out there. Kings of the Killer Fish.
Good stuff. Sean Parkinson. Good stuff. And so I was like, man, that must mean it's truly a great song because there's no bad versions or covers.
Yeah.
But wait,
howdy.
There is a pretty awful one, and it's by Cher.
Oh
gosh. Ooh. Don't listen to it.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Are you sure?
Play a little of it and we'll throw up and belch Twix pie together. Listen to this awfulness.
Ew. I'm grossed out already. It could get better though.
Just yesterday morning, whoa. They let me know that you were gone.
You were gone.
Oh, hold on.
No, stop. No, stop it, Rob.
I don't think I'm feeling it.
Stop it. No, no.
What's wrong with it? Tell me what's wrong with it.
Everything. The vocal line. It's just... Stop. Pause it for a minute.
Wait, I gotta hear the chorus.
Come on. She shared it up. No.
Oh, okay. No, she lost me there.
Yeah.
Frail.
No.
No. Okay. All right.
No. There are parts I like, and the part is when it ends. That's the only part of this song that I can take.
Oh, man.
And the bass player is not bad, but other than that, I mean, he's doing some slide.
I was okay because I was thinking, I Got You, Babe era.
Hippie Cher,
which is what that would have been.
Gotcha, with Sunny.
And I thought, okay, I'm feeling it. But then she got to, she's on a day, little thought never ends.
Then she got, never mind. Then she got as the...
Stop sharing.
Yeah. Are you Cher? So that's what I've got on covers.
Those are, but mostly, yeah, pretty solid. Pretty solid. Okay, get this. Here's a random James Taylor note. His 1976 Greatest Hits album has sold over 12 million copies. By the way, you've got Gold. That's the first, like, there's probably a silver status, maybe $50,000.
Status out there.
Yeah, right. I love the joke from Larry the Cable Guy, who said on one of their comedy tour things, he's like, you can use that joke on your next record, they'll go aluminum.
Thanks for coming by, Larry the Cable Guy.
That's hey, buddy. Guest. I didn't think you'd make it. Hey, try Prolosecco DC.
That's pretty good, man. I like you stopping by, Larry.
New sponsor. Thanks, Prolosecco TC.
Ron White was signing wine bottles at in Hendersonville the other day.
Of course he was.
And there was a ridiculous line. I was trying to get home because of the traffic, and Ron White was backing it up with his...
Really? Yeah. Was he in the road?
No, there's this liquor store right there on Center Point Road in Hendersonville, and I guess everybody from the greater south decided they want to come buy Ron White's wine because he would sign it for free, and it was a train wreck.
Wow.
Yeah, so at least he's got a following.
That's true. So wait a minute. Where were we? Oh yes. Okay. So you've got Gold Records.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's probably a certified silver, maybe by the recording industry. That's probably 50,000 copies. 100,000 copies is gold. 1 million copies is platinum. 10 million copies is diamond. And so this record is certified. His greatest hits record, that is certified diamond, having sold over 12 million copies. And get this. This is astonishing to me. Every album that James Taylor released from 1977 to 2007. That's 30 years. Every album that he released over that period sold over 1 million copies.
That's amazing.
I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Shocking. I don't know how many albums that was, but it's 30 years.
Yeah, that's impressive.
How many people have done that ever? You know what I'm saying? That's a whole lot.
That Greatest Hits album, if you were to say, JP, what album have you listened to the most in your lifetime? It would probably be that one.
Really?
Because I love it, and I've listened to it at every stage of life. Like, I listened to it when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was in the youth group, I took two long trips to Mexico, and we kept the movie Remember the Titans on the entire time.
Oh, no.
It was like 30-something times that it played.
My golly, you're going to remember those Titans.
It was either that or the movie The Pistol, and somehow the movie The Pistol broke or something. So we watched Remember the Titans. All of you from my youth group that are listening can vouch that. And I played this CD on repeat.
Just
to get away from Remember the Titans. And so I had this CD and 40 Acres by Cademan's Call. Those were my two albums. And so by default, I listened to this one the most. And, hours of time on a bus.
Literally, that really kind of upped the average
for the amount of time that you've
listened to this song.
So, but that
I mean, great, this album.
This album. That
yeah.
Would
so, yeah. So that's not even counting his Greatest Hits album. His Greatest Hits album came out in 76. And then starting in the next year, if you take everything that he released for the following 30 years, everything else has sold
amazing.
1 million copies. That's insane. You got anything else? I've just got some kind of notes here and
nuggets.
There.
His mom's name is Gertrude Woodard.
Of course.
She was an opera singer, and I really just wanted to say Gertrude.
Yeah.
So I just put that on there.
Cool, yeah.
He was married to Carly Simon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Didn't end well.
Did not end well. Was also married and divorced Catherine Walker, but she was the one that helped him get off heroin.
Oh.
And that helped him write the song Copperline, which is in my top three James Taylor songs.
Shouts out to Catherine Walker.
I love Copperline. You know that?
Good on you. Oh, yeah, sure.
That's a good one. So.
Mm-hmm. Garth Brooks named his first child Taylor in James Taylor's honor.
Did not know that.
Huge James Taylor fan. And there's some great story from Garth Brooks. I think it was like the first time that he sang in front of James Taylor or something. I just remember a clip from like Storytellers where he's talking about being so nervous and he had tears popping on his guitar strings and all this. It's very, so he's like huge James Taylor mark.
That's cool.
Is Garth Brooks. By the way, for all the OG Great Song podcast listeners out there, I have an update to the great debate of season one from the episode where we talked about friends in low places.
Give some backstory question and everything.
Okay, so a little backstory. We started to debate mid-episode. We did not realize that we saw this song from different angles. And so my perspective was, I thought that the song "Friends in Low Places" was about a guy whose girl left him for another guy, and he, Garth, the narrator, the protagonist, was interrupting them at a fancy dinner, like that they were having dinner at a fancy restaurant, and he went and caused a ruckus there. And JP and many others of you out there thought that it was the setting of the song was a wedding. That she was getting married, remarried, or well, maybe not remarried, but married to this guy, and that the setting is he went and interrupted a wedding. And so we started to dig into the song, and we asked you guys your opinions, and most of you thought that it was at a wedding, but a few of you were with me that you thought, you know, it was somewhere else. And so we started digging into video archives and all this stuff to see if we could find a clue, and there was no clear-cut answer. But shout out to podcast listener Adam Connor, who is the world's biggest Garth Brooks fan, goes to Nashville regularly to either see Garth live or to hear, do anything connected with Garth. He's a big, 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 big fan. And he got introduced to me on Facebook through a mutual friend. He attended a very cool event that I wish I could have attended personally in Nashville, where a bunch of writers who had written songs that Garth recorded got together and played those songs at one of the one of the clubs, bars, smaller venues in Nashville, and it's a very kind of intimate thing. And so he ends up there running into and meeting Earl Bud Lee,
the Earl of Bud Lee,
one of the co-writers of Friends in Low Places. What are the stinking odds of this? And was kind enough to tell me what he found out. And so here is the official answer from Earl Bud Lee regarding Friends in Low Places. He said, his exact reply was, "I bought a bottle of blueberry brandy after we wrote it, and I don't remember." So
a little anticlimactic to our question and quest for answers.
But nonetheless, huge shouts out to Adam Connor for trying to ascertain that when you had the moment. Like you shot your shot with Earl Bud Lee.
We should send you a prize of unspeakable value.
Absolutely.
Just for that. Stand by and we will get your address and you will receive some prize of unspeakable value.
I mean, what a guy. Thanks so much for trying. That's probably the only opportunity that we'll have, because I think the other guy that wrote it, he lives in Mexico or on some island somewhere. He's off the grid at this point. And Earl Bud Lee apparently just doesn't remember and is just kind of wasted all the time. So, okay, we tried. We did our best.
We gave the people what they wanted, which was effort.
That's right. That's the best that we can do. E for effort. Okay, I have one other James Taylor note before we wrap up.
I got a couple.
Okay.
Two things.
Go ahead. Hit me with one.
I'll tell one thing. I know I keep coming back to this Troubadour tour, and maybe it's just because I really liked it, but that was number six concert tour of that era. Like, not just 2010, but like, do you know the five that were above it? Think 2010 to like 2013 or 14.
Okay, so one of them's got to be U2.
U2 is actually number two. Number two on that. Number one, you're going to be like, what?
And that's probably the round.
That was the 360. Yeah. 360 tour.
Okay.
So that was, that was number two.
So what would have been bigger than that?
And it's, you're going to be like, there is no
2010 to 2013.
But it was.
That was...
I'm going to help you because I don't think you're going to get it. Bon Jovi, the It's My Life tour was number one.
Isn't that
bigger than U2? I was like, how in the world?
Ew.
But apparently...
This is highest grossing?
This is grossing. Like, yeah, wow. I looked at it. I was like, there's
that
no way.
That is gross.
Yeah, so that was
that
number one.
That song will never
will not be on the Great
darken
song
the doors of this podcast.
And neither, even though I like it, Rob does it, the Always song, which is the world's worst lyrical
song. Oh my gosh.
Song.
Yes.
From is that the Crossroads.
This Romeo is bleeding.
That's it,
listen,
man.
Listen, let's talk. Let's just quote the first verse of that song and just listen to the number of mixed metaphors. This Romeo is bleeding, but you can't see his blood. It's nothing but some feelings that this old dog kicked up. It's been raining since you left me. Now I'm drowning in the flood. See, I've always been a fighter, but without you, I give up. That is the worst garbage I have ever heard in my life.
But raise your hand if you just quoted every lyric to it.
Gosh, you can't help it. You can't help. It's the only thing they played on school buses for like 3 years.
It was the first, one of the first songs I learned on piano. And I was at church, and they were like, "Oh, JP plays piano. Come on up and play for the altar service." And I knew like two songs, and then it kept going, and the altar. So that ended up being the Come to Jesus
I hate that song with a burning hot passion. You could literally ignite a solar system with the star supernova hatred I have for that song.
Yeah, it's not bad. Number three, AC/DC. Lady Gaga tour.
Is Rolling Stones one of them? They're always out there doing it.
And number five was the Black Eyed Peas.
That's a surprise.
Yeah, those were the top five in that era. It's 2010.
But right in there is James Taylor and Carole King.
And number six. Just out there doing it. James Taylor and Carole King.
My gosh. Tour.
So, anyway. I got that, and I got one other fact.
James Taylor reached the top of the Billboard 200 chart for the first time in 2015. 2015, he hit the top of the Billboard 200 chart with Before This World. Previously, his highest charting LP had been Mudslide Slim and the Blue Horizon, which peaked at number two in 1971. Hmm. So the follow-up to this one was his highest charting until 2015 when he finally hit number one.
Can you pull up what's on Mudslide Slim? Because I would try to think what would put that over this one.
Yeah, give me a second. Well, it's one of those things where he probably got aided, like, you know when like Adele got huge?
You're hot.
And then the next album is hotly anticipated and it comes out and everybody buys it regardless of what's on it. They've just got to have it.
That's good. I like that. That makes a lot of sense.
But for the record, the album Mudslide Slim, which is the one with him holding his suspenders on the front. Okay.
Mustache Taylor.
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. It's got You've Got a Friend, You Can Close Your Eyes, Machine Gun Kelly, Highway Song, It's Nice to Be Home Again, Let Me Ride, Long Ago and Far Away, Places in My Past, Love Has Brought Me Around, Soldiers, Mudslide Slim, Hey Mister, That's Me Up on the Jukebox.
Nothing. I mean, they're good.
Comparatively speaking, you would think. Hit Parade. His first two albums versus that one, you would think. But I think it's because of the rocket ship that was Fire and Rain.
Anything he puts out, you're going to be like, I'll buy it.
That it's next album is,
That makes sense. My last note that I had, he grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he talks a lot about the outlying hills and tranquil and it's quiet. And when I think of Chapel Hill, I think nothing about that. I think about basketball. The Tar Heels. Absolutely. So the North Carolina Tar Heels. Michael Jordan, James Worthy, Rasheed Wallace, Vince Carter, Jerry Stackhouse, all kind of similar players. So I looked up, what do North Carolina Tar Heels fans think the number one Tar Heel of all time is?
Well, it's got to be Jordan.
It's got to be Jordan. What I'm thinking. Wrong.
What?
Tyler Hansbrough.
Really?
By a landslide. If you ask true Tar Heel fans who the greatest Tar Heel, because of all he did in college basketball. Okay. He won Player of the Year multiple times. And he had a good career as a Tar Heel,
I got you.
Whereas Jordan,
sort of like people say Tim Tebow is maybe the greatest college player of all time. But you wouldn't say Tim Tebow is one of the greatest players.
Yep.
You would just ask Gator fans, like who's, and they might say Tim Tebow.
Yep, that's so Tyler Hansbrough, shout out to you.
Hey,
good job, well done.
Good on you, man. You outdid Michael Jordan.
You did
in his own college.
The same guy that beat him out for his high school spot. You beat him out for college.
Exactly.
So there you go. Sorry, Bobby Hansen, you did not beat him out in the NBA as the other guy.
True. Wow. Okay, well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Great Song Podcast. Thanks for listening wherever you are. Give us some love on social media. Share our episodes. Let other people know. If you're liking the show, the best thing you could do for us is to just let people know that you're listening and that you're enjoying it. Do that subscribe, do that like, do that 5-star review, and it really helps us out there. So thanks so much for listening wherever you are right now. Thanks for spending 45 minutes to an hour of your week with us every week. We took a little hiatus between season one and season two, and so many of you reached out to us and said, when is the next episode coming? When do I get to listen again?
Where did you go?
My Friday morning is incomplete because I don't have you guys to listen to at work or on my drive or whatever.
Or on the toilet. I mean, that's the greatest compliments you can give to us is where'd you go?
It's true.
So thank you so much.
Absolutely. You've made us part of your life part of your routine. That's amazing. So
we're back.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're so glad to be back with you. And we got some more songs in as we continue season two of the Great Song Podcast that we cannot wait to bring you. We're excited. We're hyped. We're ready to go. We got the research machine rolling again. We're recording and coming up with new ideas and new ways to bring you interesting stuff. So thanks so much for being with us. And we will see you next time. I'm Rob.
I am JP.
Go listen to some music.